Is your patient suffering from perplexing symptoms that frustrate both of you? Because nothing adds up? Normal exam, normal labs, unrevealing workup. Could it be menopause? Well, learn the commonly overlooked symptoms of menopause and what to do next. Dr. Lauren Stryker is a clinical professor of OBGYN at Northwestern and the founding medical director of the Northwestern Medicine Center for Sexual Medicine and Menopause. She's a certified menopause practitioner of the Menopause Society, serves on the editorial board of the journal Menopause, and is a senior research fellow for the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. She's a fellow of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and is a member of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. She's also the best-selling author of multiple books, including The Essential Guide to Hysterectomy, The Sex Rx, Hormones, Health, and Your Best Sex Ever, Sliding Away, Turning Back the Clock on Your Vagina, and Hot Flash Hell, A Gynecologist's Guide to Turning Down the Heat. Dr. Stryker, spelled S-T-R-E-I-C-H-E-R, is the host of Inside Information, Midlife, Menopause, and More, and the creator of Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm, a solution-driven 30-episode audio series to address the biological reasons for loss of libido, pain with sexual activity, and post-menopause difficulty with orgasm. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, a show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs. I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. Dr. Lauren Stryker, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
My pleasure to be here. Lots to talk about.
So if you could train every physician to associate menopause with three symptoms that are not hot flash, right? Not the ones that are the red flag that everyone goes to, but the more esoteric symptoms. What are those three symptoms? What do you want us to take away from today?
Okay, well, first of all, I wouldn't call them esoteric symptoms because esoteric to me implies that they're rare symptoms. What I want to talk about are the common symptoms that healthcare professionals see every day, and I'm talking the non-gynecologists, and they don't necessarily associate it with menopause. So at the top of the list, absolutely, unequivocally, is recurrent urinary tract infections. Okay. So many older women suffer from recurrent urinary tract infections, and they get into this cycle of antibiotics, yeast infection. Maybe you need a cystoscopy again and again and again. And in almost all cases of postmenopausal women that are getting new onset of recurrent urinary tract infections, this is a symptom of a phrase that a lot of people are familiar with, genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which refers to the changes that occur not just in the vulva and the vagina, but also in the urinary tract. Basically, there are two things going on that cause these recurrent urinary tract infections. One is there's a change in the vaginal microbiome, which makes it more likely for there to be E. coli that get up to the bladder. But second is that because of the atrophy, the thinning and drying of the tissue that occurs in the urethra and in the bladder, it's much more vulnerable to getting an infection. So okay. Women get plagued with this stuff and end up on this roller coaster that they're never told that this is a consequence of menopause. And it's one of the world's easiest things to treat because we know that local vaginal estrogen in the form of a cream, a pill, a suppository, there's a lot of different options, are going to, if not eradicate it, dramatically reduce it. And we used to tell people, you know, you can just take that cream and put it right on your urethra. But now we know that's not enough because we also need to change the vaginal microbiome. So there is no contraindications, none, zero, to using local vaginal estrogen. This can be used by women with breast cancer who are on an aromatase inhibitor, and it will make all the difference in the world. So that's at the top of my list. Okay. Number two, let's talk palpitations. Because when women start to have palpitations, who do they see? They go to see their family practice doc. They go to see their internist because they are sure that they are about to drop dead of some horrible cardiac condition. And what we know is that up to 50% of women in perimenopause and early postmenopause are going to have palpitations. And
so when you say palpitations, is this like for our cardiologist? No. I know symptomatically, but are these like PVCs or is this a sign of some impending arrhythmia? Right.
What it is. What it is like vasomotor symptoms. This is a hormonally driven temporary autonomic dysfunction.
Okay.
There was a study that came out July of this year that was published in Menopause, and it basically took a group of women who went to their doctors complaining of palpitations, and they put on one of these EKG patches that they were able to wear for a month so they can monitor it. Yeah. And what they found is that the majority of the women who had these palpitations, there were no EKG changes.
Oh, interesting.
There were EKG changes. It was atrial tachycardia. Not all, but almost all of these episodes of palpitations were associated with a vasomotor hot flash. And interestingly, the most likely group to have palpitations is women with diabetes. And what they also found is that there was very, very rarely any truly significant life-threatening arrhythmias or tachycardias. So the point is, the way to think of it is, this is a hot flash of the heart as opposed to underlying cardiac abnormality. You still need to do the Holter because some women are going to have something.
Absolutely.
But when the woman walks in the door and says, I'm having palpitations, the first thing to do is to reassure her and say, you know, we're going to check it out. But most likely you're not about to drop dead of a heart attack. This is most likely a symptom of menopause.
Well, I'm no cardiologist, but I would think chest pain would be more associated with like an impending MI than an arrhythmia, but they could be worried that they're atrial fibrillation or something like that. But so what you're saying is when the cardiologist or the primary care physician does the EKG, there's not going to be a finding concurrent with the symptoms that they feel like they're having a palpitation, but there's not even like sinus tachycardia. Like nothing?
Sometimes there is. Sometimes sinus tachycardia is the most common thing you're going to see. But a lot of times you're not going to see anything. And, you know, the palpitation obviously is real. Also, in this study they looked at, was it associated with someone being anxious? And it wasn't. It was the most common thing was associated with was either being diabetic and, of course, you know, vasomotor symptoms. It's very common. And this is a temporary thing. That's the other thing. This is one, like hot flashes. This is really during the perimenopause and late early postmenopause. And it can last for years. It can come and go for years. But again, the most important thing is to reassure women that, okay, let's check it out. But
so
you're not crazy. You are having these palpitations, but like your hot flashes, this is just your body getting used to life without estrogen or fluctuating estrogen levels.
So I want to get into more symptoms, but I want to explore this a little more because I think there's a communication issue too here. So one is if you're that so you've seen primary, you did the EKG, EKG's normal, you send them to cardiology, electrophysiology, you've done the Holter monitor. During those episodes, you don't see anything on the EKG. And so you're six, because you listen to this episode, you now suspect that it could be the, as you call them, these cardiac hot flashes of perimenopause.
Mm-hmm.
So what should that cardiologist do? Okay.
Well, from my point of view, this is not the diagnosis after you've done the whole workup. This is the first diagnosis. The first thing out of your mouth should be, you're having palpitations. You're most likely perimenopausal or menopausal. And did you know that 50% of women during this time of life have palpitations? And good news, in most cases, it is not an indication of a problem with your heart.
Okay.
But we're going to check it out. So this should be the first sentence, not the last sentence. And then as far as what you do about it, the majority of these women are also going to be having hot flashes. They do tend to go hand in hand. And of course, we need to talk about what needs to be done about the hot flashes. And when I say you don't need to do anything about the palpitations, what I mean is if that's the only symptom they're having, and if you declare that that's, you know, the issue, you do not have to do anything but reassure her. If it's associated with hot flashes, then, you know, treating the hot flash is also going to treat the palpitations.
And so the communication thing that I want to ask about is how do you tell the patient that the symptom that they're having is related to menopause without being dismissive, right? Because it be heard as, right, like it's all in your head or you need to lose weight or, you know, all the ways that we tend to poorly communicate.
She's already decided it's menopause before she comes to see you. because we know that these women that have these symptoms, they, you know, go right to their computer and they Google it and they consult AI. And no matter what their symptom is, they think it's menopause. So I can guarantee you that you are not going to shock anybody who's in their mid to late 40s or early 50s to say, I think fill in the blank is because you are, you know, it's hormonal, it's perimenopause or menopause. That's not being dismissive. Yeah, that's what comes after is the dismissive part. If you say, I think this is perimenopause, suck it up. That's dismissive.
Okay.
But saying it's perimenopause or menopause is not dismissive. You are validating what they have already decided or been told based on what they've read on social media or AI or wherever. This is not going to be shocking to someone unless it's an outlier or someone who's, you know, very early or something like that. But your typical woman who walks in the door, who's having fill in the blank, hot flashes, insomnia, weight gain, palpitations, she's already suspected that it's perimenopause. And in fact, will walk in the door and sometimes tell you that. She'll say, I know I'm perimenopausal because I have blah, blah, blah. And the thing that's really hard is to say, actually, this isn't because you're perimenopausal. It's because of something else. Or it might be, but it also might be something else. So your point is well taken as far as not being dismissive. The way to not be dismissive of the symptom is to not be dismissive. You know, you don't say, oh, this is perimenopause or menopause. Everyone goes through it. No big deal. You know, suck it up. The approach is to say, this could be because of hormonal changes, which occur during perimenopause and menopause. And this is unlikely to be the only symptom you're having. So let's talk about other things that you're experiencing and what things might be from menopause or might be from something else. And then, you know, in a perfect world, what we do, and in the menopause clinic that I ran, we would give women a whole list of symptoms and say, check off which symptoms you're having in terms of the ones that are mild, moderate, or severe. And of course, they're going to check off 9 million things. And then you say, because you only have about 3 minutes to do this whole visit, you don't have 45 minutes. And then you say, okay, of all of the things you've checked off, which are the things that are really bothering you that you want to address? And usually it's surprisingly few. You know, they might check off 20 things, but they feel heard. That's the important part. You know, getting to the dismissive thing is you have expressed an interest, you have acknowledged that she's having all these symptoms, and now you are saying, and what are the ones that are most bothersome to you? What do you want to address? And I think a lot of docs, they don't go there because A, they don't have the time, and I totally get that. I've been in private practice and, you know, had the time constraints. You're dealing with a lot of other stuff. But there's also this idea that you personally then have to deal with it. You know, if someone says, I am having god-awful hot flashes and my vagina is like the Sahara Desert, and you say, you know, we can help you with that. There are people who know a lot about that. And I'm not that person, but I'm going to refer you to someone who is, and then you do that. Or if you are that person, then you say, I'm so glad you brought that up or that I've asked you and we've discussed this, but this is not a 5-minute visit. Yeah. We're going to make another appointment. I'm going to give you some resources. I'm going to give you some stuff to read. I'm going to have you come back and so we can sit down and do this another time. Because you know, you don't do annual visits because you're an ENT. But if you're a family medicine doctor or if you're an internist and people come for their once a year visit, which is allotted, you know, 20 minutes usually, they think everything's going to happen during that visit. And people don't appreciate that that's a screening visit. And that if you actually have an issue.
Oh, yeah. We've had episodes on that communication. And the spin is that sounds like something that's so significant that it really requires the attention of its own visit. We can't just think of that issue like an afterthought. Come with me. Yeah. We'll schedule that follow up and then we can give that issue the attention that it deserves.
Yeah. But it's not dismissive if, and this is where the questionnaire comes in. When you give someone this whole questionnaire and you can say, okay, now I get it. You know, I understand what the issue is so that when you come back for your next visit, you don't have to do the questionnaire right then. You can say, I want to do a menopause consultation. And if you don't want to, if you're in a world that you're just not interested in menopause, that's okay. Just have in ready to go resources and someone to refer them to. Because you're not minimizing the importance, you're actually elevating the importance by saying, this is a big deal and this takes a lot of expertise. I don't have that expertise. It's no different than if someone goes to a doctor, even, you know, any doctor and says, I've been trying to get pregnant for a year and I can't. You're not going to do that fertility evaluation yourself. You're going to say, wow, that must be really frustrating for you. I'd like to help you out with that. I'm going to refer you to a fertility clinic. Same thing.
So far we've got recurring urinary tract infections, We've got
patience.
So what's next with those common symptoms of menopause that we absolutely can't miss?
Well, and again, I'm really trying to stick to things that people are going to come to a generalist with, to a primary care doctor with. So number three is joint pain, because older people get joint pain, older people get arthritis, men get it too. However, we do know that there are estrogen receptors in the joints. Most people are aware of the fact we have estrogen in receptors in the bone and that we lose bone post-menopause, and certainly we can talk about that. But there's also estrogen receptors in the joints. And what people don't appreciate is that post-menopause, when women lose their estrogen, is if someone has arthritis, it's going to get worse. If they don't have arthritis that's obvious yet, they may present with joint pain. And we're also understanding now that many women that walk in the door with frozen shoulder and other joint issues, it's specifically because of menopause. And they're not seeing their gynecologist for this stuff. You know, they are going to other doctors who may not be aware that these are absolutely one of the symptoms of menopause.
So let's say there's an orthopedic surgeon or a physiatrist listening and they're seeing someone. How is this patient going to present differently? And how do we work them up differently, right? Because as we age, we get more joint pain, as you said. So how do we know that it's specifically perimenopausal joint pain, and how do we work that up any differently?
Well, the first thing is, as best you can, is to try and figure out what their hormonal status is.
Okay.
And sometimes it's really easy. If someone walks in the door and says, I had my ovaries out a month ago and now my joints are killing me, yeah, there's your diagnosis.
Yeah, but someone, they don't often do that on a silver platter,
they
right?
They generally do not.
No.
Or if someone says, boy, they might not put it together themselves, but you ask, what's going on? Are you still having periods? Are you having hot flashes? Are you having vaginal dryness?
Yes,
you
know, I know my orthopedic surgery colleagues are definitely going to be asking about their period and their vaginal dryness.
That's correct. And the other thing also is the problem of everyone knows the definition of menopause, right? It's drilled into everybody. 12 months without a period. Okay, well, that's highly problematic because first of all, it's retrospective. But second of all, about 50% of women don't get a period. We have about a third of women who've had a hysterectomy. We have people who have maybe a progestogen IUD. We have women who've had an endometrial ablation. So there's lots of women who don't get periods. So you don't have that to go by. So it does take a little more detective work. And quite frankly, the age of the patient more than anything else is going to tell you that, because if they're in their mid to late 40s, early 50s, and they're saying, wow, my joints have suddenly gotten so much achier. I have this frozen shoulder. I have this, I can't play tennis anymore because I just can't raise my arm. That should trigger our, okay, you are in the age group that this may be an indication, not just of aging, but also of a change in your hormones. You know, most of these things, it's not that it's just menopause. Some things are just menopause. You know, vaginal dryness is just menopause. But when you look at a lot of these other symptoms that we talk about, it's multifactorial.
Yeah.
Estrogen is only one component of a lot of these symptoms. And that's why, you know, you start off by talking hot flashes, and, you know, a woman in that age group is menopause until proven otherwise. And vaginal dryness is menopause until proven otherwise. Joint pain, not necessarily, but it's on the list, and it's on the list of something that could cause a significant change in what was already happening.
If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the other shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, The Purposeful MD. Dr. Laura Sutton, who was previously a guest on this show, helps you rediscover your passion with The Purposeful MD. She guides you through overcoming burnout and finding fulfillment in your medical career. It's time to practice medicine on your terms. Subscribe and embark on a journey to a more purposeful practice with The Purposeful MD. So you mentioned frozen shoulder. Are you going to see like isolated joint pain? Or are you going to see, is this patient coming in with like a litany of complaints? My back, my shoulder, my... Okay, so it could be, you know, one isolated joint. Still, we need to be considering this.
That's correct. When I did a podcast with an orthopedic surgeon, Vonda Wright, who has identified something called musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause, and she wrote a very nice paper about it, and I did a podcast with her, and the floodgates opened of patients saying, OMG, that's me. I was very active. Everything was great. Yeah. I had a frozen shoulder. No one ever told me this was menopause. And it is. We know that it is. It's not the only reason for frozen shoulder. Of course it's not. But we do see a significant increase in these joint issues around the time of early and postmenopause, which can in many cases be prevented by hormone therapy and, of course, physical activity.
Okay, but so how do we manage it differently? Like you had mentioned topical estrogen. Are we using it like diclofenac, like you're putting it in gel form, like on the joint?
No,
like
what are you? This is okay. Systemic estrogen to get to the joints. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to give someone systemic estrogen, but this is not a topical.
Got it. And so the orthopedic surgeon in that situation is going to say, hey, let's deal with your shoulder, but also you should discuss this with your gynecologist because they might want to consider some systemic therapy. And then, you know, keep it vague.
We got to let them decide. You discuss this with a menopause expert. Because unfortunately, most gynecologists do not have expertise in menopause or hormone therapy. And sometimes a menopause expert's a gynecologist, sometimes it's an internist, sometimes it's a family medicine doctor. A lot of different fields have kind of morphed into being menopause experts and know something about hormone therapy. I wish all gynecologists were, so someone can start perhaps with their gynecologist. But the message should be you need to talk to a menopause expert. Your gynecologist might have an expertise in menopause, but they might not. Okay. And if they don't, then let's help you find someone who does.
Got it. Okay. So joint pain, recurring UTIs, palpitations. Nope. I said three. We're going to go through three, but that was my number. Are there any other symptoms that we should not be missing?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a long list because what we now know is that estrogen receptors are basically in every single part of our body. It's not just in the reproductive system. I mean, you name the part, whether it's your ears, your skin, your mouth, you know, your hair. I mean, estrogen is going to impact that. So really, my attitude is that not everything is menopause. Of course it's not. But if you have a woman who is midlife, who's in that age range and has a symptom, and particularly if you're not a menopause expert, it would be well worth your while to check out before you say dismiss it to see if sometimes it is associated with menopause. Because, you know, one of the things that I write about and talk about a lot is of these symptoms, which can be helped by estrogen therapy, systemic therapy, and which cannot be helped with it, and which are unknown because we have the research. But another one that I think is big for the person out there as a primary care doctor is brain fog, because women think they're going to have dementia because they're 50 years old and they can't remember why they walked in the room and they can't remember the name of the person who they've known their whole life and they're not functioning at work. And they all think this is early onset dementia or Alzheimer's, when in fact, we know that this is very likely perimenopausal brain fog. And perimenopausal brain fog, like vasomotor symptoms, like palpitations, is temporary. It is not an early indication of dementia. Women need to be reassured. And if for women who it's a real problem, we know that perimenopausal and early postmenopause hormone therapy will dramatically alleviate that brain fog. But a lot of docs don't know that. And then they send them off to get tests for dementia and say, gee, it could be early onset Alzheimer's. And it's terrifying, as you can well imagine. And it's very, very common.
So let's talk about hormone replacement therapy before we go back to some more symptoms. Because when I was in medical school, which is the last time I heard about hormone replacement therapy, because we don't really do that as otolaryngologists, was that they had tried it to prevent cardiac disease in women, right? Because we see that after menopause, their cardiac risk factors go significantly up. So they tried treating that with hormone replacement therapy. And what they found was an increase in uterine and ovarian cancer.
No, let's go back because you're talking about the Women's Health Initiative. So let me back this up a little bit. First of all, we no longer call it hormone replacement therapy. HRT is husband replacement therapy. Very useful, sometimes helps a lot, but that is not what we call it now. We call it either menopausal hormone therapy or hormone therapy. And that's very specific. And the reason why is we're not replacing your hormones. When someone has their thyroid removed, we're giving them the equivalent of what they used to make before their thyroid was removed.
Yes.
When we are giving someone hormone therapy, we are not giving them levels that match what they were in their 20 or 30s. What we are doing is giving very, very small amounts of estrogen, progestogen, and sometimes testosterone in order to alleviate symptoms of perimenopause and postmenopause. So when you're talking about WHI, the Women's Health Initiative, of course, was this large study that was initially, as you said, the purpose of the study was to determine if hormone therapy would prevent cardiovascular disease, which is the number one killer of women, because there was data before that that was suggestive. And what they did in this, in the WHI, as a lot of people are aware, is there were three groups. There were the women that got conjugated equine estrogens and a synthetic progestin, medroxyprogesterone acetate. Group two was women who had a hysterectomy, so they did not need to get the progestin, and they just got estrogen alone, conjugated estrogens. And group three got the placebo. And the study was supposed to go on for at least 7 to 8 years. They stopped it abruptly at 5 years because they found that there was a slight, not even really clinically significant, increase in breast cancer in the estrogen and progestin group. And they found that there was not a decrease in cardiovascular disease and that there was an increase in blood clot. So they stopped the whole thing. And, you know, sometimes you hear the WHI was a bad study. The WHI was an outstanding study. It was a prospective, randomly controlled, very large-scale study that we learned a lot from. The problem with the WHI is that it was a very, very specific group of women that were in it that was problematic. And then, of course, the specific hormone therapy products were problematic. So if we look at the women in the WHI, 70% of the women were over the age of 60. Now, why did they have all these older women? Well, the reason they had all these older women is because they didn't want women to know if they were getting placebo or the real deal. So therefore, they only enrolled women who were no longer having hot flashes. So the problem with that is that you basically have two groups of women. You have women that had never had a hot flash. There's about 20% of women that have never had hot flashes, and they are not at increased risk for cardiovascular disease for a variety of reasons we can talk about. Those are not the women that are getting heart problems. Or they were women who did have hot flashes, but they were done with them because now they're 10 years later.
Yeah.
The damage was already done. So we have a group of women who already had cardiovascular disease. They did not control for statins. They did not control for a lot of other cardiovascular factors. And lo and behold, these women did not do well. They ended up having more cardiovascular problems because most of them had already developed plaque, became complicated plaque. They had much higher rates of thromboembolic phenomenon. And so it was really a skewed population. And in fact, if you looked at the 50 to 60-year-old group, which was much smaller, it was only about 10% of the women in WHI, they did much better. The breast cancer thing, it was a very slight increase. And we now know that it was only in the group that got conjugated estrogens and progestin, medroxyprogesterone acetate. The women in the estrogen-only group had over a 20% decrease in breast cancer. And in fact, of the women who did develop breast cancer, they were 40% less likely to die. So we now know that conjugated equine estrogens are protective as far as breast cancer. But that memo has not gotten out to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But that's what gave it the bad, you know, the bad name, if you will. And so what we know now about hormone therapy is that ideally you want to start it in the critical window within the first 10 years of menopause transition or from age 50 to 60. We know that you want to use a different progestogen, such as a micronized progesterone, or there's a number of alternatives now. There's a selective estrogen receptor modulator called basodoxifen, which also protects the uterus, also builds bone. So there's a lot of different alternatives, and it's nuanced. And so this kind of brings me back to, it's really tricky because it used to be that a lot of doctors felt like, oh, well, I can do menopause care. And really, it's hard. It's like saying there's only one blood pressure pill. We're going to give it to everybody with high blood pressure. There's lots of different nuances to hormone therapy. It's very individualized. And it depends on someone's medical history. What's their age? What are their goals? And because it's very different if you have someone who is at risk or who's had a blood clot versus someone who is mostly just trying to protect their breasts. And so people that say, like, everyone should be on a patch, that's not true.
Yeah.
It's just not true. All very nuanced.
So we're running out of time, so I just want to make sure we get a couple more points in. So your point being that there are these menopause specialists out there that can provide people with nuanced, individualized care. And so I want to make sure that our listeners know, you know, who they should be sending. Like, and so what I want to go through is any more symptoms that we haven't discussed where having the information that this symptom is perimenopausal and can be improved with hormone therapy. So what are those other symptoms that we should be?
I know you said, let's not talk about hot flashes. Hot flashes are the most important thing to talk about. And the reason why is hot flashes are not harmless. A lot of people think like, oh, it's hot flashes, tough it out, they'll go away, no big deal. Yeah. And what we know now from very, very good studies, particularly from the SWAN study, the study of the women across the nation, which is now in its 20th year, and we've had about 500-600 studies that have come out of it. What we know is that the women who have moderate to severe hot flashes are the women who are most likely to have stroke, cardiovascular disease, bone loss. You know, the list is very long. What we know is with these hot flashes is that there is an increase in cortisol, a body-wide inflammatory response. And so when you look at menopausal women, as far as I'm concerned, there's two groups. There's the flashers and there's non-flashers. The flashers need to make those hot flashes go away.
Yeah.
Most people have hot flashes on average 7 years. Black women, it's more like 10 years. They're more severe, they last longer, and the damage is greater. We have so many options now, both hormonal and non-hormonal. The new non-hormonal options are the Candy neuron inhibitors. I don't know if you're familiar with these, fezolinetant and elinzanetant. They've both been FDA approved in the last 3 to 4 years. These are completely non-hormonal, and these are oral medications which knock out the hot flashes almost as well as hormone therapy. They're not going to do anything else as far as bone health, the vagina, and all of that, but they do get rid of the hot flashes. So there's a whole world out there, because a lot of people will say, well, you know, my patient doesn't want to take hormone therapy or she can't. We have non-hormonal options as well, but those hot flashes cannot be dismissed.
Okay, so the hot flashes, and they just want to make sure that this stuff doesn't get missed too, which is the GI symptoms. So if you've got a patient with GI symptoms, you can have microbiome changes, right, that cause these, like, you know, we've got lots of patients out there with these like nebulous GI symptoms, and we're not sure what to do with them. They've had the endoscopies and the imaging, and right, and so that those can be perimenopausal. For my field, xerostomia, so dry mouth causing taste changes. I mean, listen, the mucosa is dry, right? Like your vaginal mucosa is dry. Well, it's mucosa. So you have nasal mucosa, you've got oral mucosa, you've got pharyngeal mucosa. So
I know you don't want to hear this. The mouth and the vagina are the same. It's both mucosa. They both have the same thing with estrogen receptors. And one of the studies I did, I just presented this study at the medical conference, was looking at the rate of women who have both xerostomia and vaginal dryness, and the correlation is very, very high. And I mean, you know this. This is your world. It's not just about being uncomfortable and having dry mouth. It's associated with all kinds of dental and oral cancers and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So this is not something to be minimized. And that's an area that I'm doing some research in, and that we need to do a lot more research in.
Topical estrogen for that? Has Are there like studied. Estrogen rinses?
Has not been studied. That's something I'm actually thinking about, and we could talk about that another time. But yeah, that's something that has not been studied. But there have been some studies with systemic estrogen to see if it helps with xerostomia, and very inconsistent, not well done studies. So it's a big problem, but there's really not, you know, when I lecture to medical students and I tell them that there's not a specialty that doesn't need to know about this stuff, because it really impacts every organ system, some more than others.
And then derm, right? You're going to get dry skin, your hair's going to fall out, you get alopecia, right? That can be perimenopausal as well.
And postmenopausal. I mean, you know, one of the things I differentiated when I lecture about this stuff is perimenopausal symptoms that are temporary, that are going to go away, like hot flashes and palpitations. And then, you know, this idea of I'm done with menopause. You know when you're done with menopause? When you die. You know?
So then why do they call it menopause?
I don't. It's menopause forever. And so menopause forever. And,
you know,
basically, most women say they're done with menopause when they're no longer flashing. But, you know, you're never going to start making estrogen again. And the repercussions on the vulva of the vagina, the clitoris, your sex life, your bones, all of that is lifelong. And so if a woman comes in and you say, are you having issues with menopause? And she says she's done with menopause. The first thing you should say is, you may not be having symptoms, but we still have to address the repercussions of no longer making estrogen. Does every woman need hormone therapy? No, they do not. But many women do benefit from it, and it's an individual evaluation.
Okay, so one more thing before we go, and that is, if there's something that you hear either other doctors saying to their patients, oh, my doctor told me this, or you see physicians posting online, this bit of misinformation that's out there that you want to clear up that we haven't gotten to yet. Is there one more thing
you want
to...
Okay, this is number one.
Okay.
Don't mess with my hormones. If I put a patient on hormone therapy and then she goes to see her internist or her family doctor who says, oh my God, you've been on them for 5 years, it's time to come off. How would you feel if they came to me and I said, you've been on your blood pressure medication for 5 years, I want you to stop immediately. You go nuts, you know? There is no reason to stop hormone therapy. If you think that there is, please call the person who prescribed it first. Do not, you know, weigh in on that, because even the most conservative of conservative societies, like the Menopause Society, says you can take hormone therapy forever. There is no time limit. There is no five-year thing. The mantra of the smallest amount for the shortest amount of time was never based on any evidence. Please stop taking patients off their hormone therapy unless you are the one that put them on it and you have a really good reason to do so.
Don't open my fridge and eat my food without asking me first.
No, yeah. Seriously.
For any reason, don't stop a medicine that I've started without asking
right.
me. Yes.
Yeah, of course.
For any reason.
Call the prescriber.
For any reason. Yeah.
But people do this all the time with hormone therapy. It's amazing to me. They'll come back and they'll say, I'm no longer taking my hormone therapy. Why? My intern has said I've been on it long enough.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, if people want to learn more about you, actually tell us about your course.
All right. So my website is drstreicher.com.
Wait, tell us how to spell that. Because it's not
Streicher. I have a podcast, Dr. Stryker's Inside Information. It's everywhere. It's free. It is really geared towards a consumer audience, but it is very high level. And I have about 50% healthcare professionals that listen in on my podcast. I also have a course called Come Again. We have not talked about sex today. I don't know why, but we have not. I have to say the word.
I did get vagina and mouth, all that.
But one of my areas of interest is postmenopause sexuality. If you think doctors don't know anything about menopause, they know less about postmenopause sexuality. 50% of your patients are having difficulty with orgasm, pain with sexual activity, inability to become aroused, and their libido's in the toilet. So I have a course called Come Again. And this is a course that is 30 audio episodes, which is directed for both consumer and healthcare professionals. But then I have a separate package just for healthcare professionals, which is an entire course of lectures that I give on how to take a sexual history, what's your script, how to do it, how to evaluate a patient who has sexual problems, what's the physical exam, what do you need to do, what do you need to know. I give you the screeners to use in the office. I give you the articles that you need to read. So you go to drstreicher.com/comeagain. Hit the healthcare professional tab. And it's really a whole education that fills in the gaps of what most doctors never get, even today. Because you went to medical school 20 years ago. Even today, people are not getting this education.
Well, we had Dr. Rachel Rubin, who's a urologist, on the show a while ago, talking about that sexual history needs to be in the social history. And it sounds like you were a big proponent of that as well. Yes.
Well, no, I mean, as Rachel and I both say, and Rachel and I are on the same stage all the time together. In fact, I just talked to her yesterday, that, you know, the idea that people ask about sex right after smoking and, you know, do you own a gun, makes it sound like this is something that's not going to end well. And it's offensive. And we don't have time to talk about it today. But the question that should never, never, never be asked of any patient is, are you sexually active? Ever. There is no greater conversation stopper. It is a meaningless question. In my Come Again course, I will tell you what you should ask instead.
That we got to stick the course to learn that? Come on. How do I ask that question?
All right.
How do I do
one sentence? I'm going to give you part of the script. The question is not, are you sexually active? If you have a patient who hasn't had sex in 5 years because it hurts like hell, and you say to her, are you sexually active? What's she going to say?
That's judgy. Yeah.
It's not judgy. She's just going to say no. And then you can move on because you think she's not sexually active. Or, you know, she masturbates and she can't have an orgasm and she's really bummed out about that. But you say, are you sexually active? And she's going to say no. Don't ask that question. The question is, many women who, and then fill in the blank, have diabetes, have heart disease, have menopause, whatever you want. Many women who have fill in the blank have difficulty with their ability to have an orgasm, low libido, or pain with sexual activity. Are any of those a problem for you? Booyah. They're either going to say no, and then you say, if that ever changes, let me know. And if they say yes, and then you're thinking, oh shit, now I've opened a can of worms. And that's why you also have to take my course so you know what to say, even if that's referring to someone else. But there are solutions for your patients who can't have an orgasm anymore because you put them on an SSRI when they maybe didn't need it because they just have hot flashes. I'm just saying.
Okay. Well, Dr. Lauren Stryker, thank you so much for your time and expertise and all you do for our profession and your patients.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review. take a screenshot and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or legal advice or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.